So I guess everyone can hear me because I don't see any hands. Now, this talk is supposed to be about copyright versus community. And I will talk about that. But I found out after I got here that if I only gave that speech, it would be missing an important opportunity. I'm told that there is a strong free software movement here. And but it has not yet succeeded in kicking the proprietary software out of this university. So that means I need to give it an impetus. I need to give a boost to the battle here, because that's what needs to be done. This school, like all other schools, should teach exclusively free software. So I am going to have to start by saying something about that, which means I need to start by explaining what free software means. Free software is software that respects your freedom and respects the social solidarity of your community. It's a matter of freedom, not price. So to understand the word free in free software, think of free speech, not free beer. Software which is not free, we call non-free software, proprietary software, user subjugating software. It keeps the users divided and helpless. Divided because they're forbidden to share copies with others, and helpless because they don't get the source code, so they can't change the program to do what they want. They can't even verify independently what that program is really doing to them. And often, it's doing something intentionally nasty. But I said it's software that respects your freedom. But that's very general. I'd better be more specific. A program is free software if you, the user, have the four essential freedoms. Freedom 0 is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom 1 is the freedom to study the source code and then change it so that the program does what you wish. Freedom 2 is the freedom to help other people. That's the freedom to redistribute exact copies to others when you wish. And freedom 3 is the freedom to contribute to your community. That's the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions to others when you wish. So if the program gives you these four freedoms, then it's free software because the social system of its distribution and use is an ethical system, one that respects freedom and community. But if one of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, then the program is proprietary software because it imposes an unjust social system on its users. So the difference between free software and proprietary software is not a technical issue at all. It's not a question of what the code does or how, not directly anyway. It's a question of the social system in which people can use it. The same code could be released as free software or as proprietary software. And sometimes the same code is released in both ways at the same time. So this is not a technical issue. It's a social, ethical, and political issue. I really dislike that one. Ugh. You have to work at it to make something taste that bad. They must have hired the person who used to work at the cough syrup company. So, where was I? So, developing a free program is generally a contribution to society. More or less of a contribution, depending on all the details. But developing a proprietary program is not a contribution, it's an attack. The proprietary program functions socially as a trap. If it has any convenient features, those are the bait for the trap. They attract people who aren't wise to surrender their freedom and become users of this program. So they don't make it better, they only make it worse and more dangerous. So if you have a choice of developing a proprietary program or doing nothing at all, it's much better to do nothing at all, because that way you don't do any harm. Developing a proprietary software package is harm. It's much better not to do it, even if you don't do anything else instead. So the goal of the be free so that all users of software can be free. But why define free software this way? Why are these four freedoms the essential ones? Each one has a reason. Freedom two, the freedom to help other people, the freedom to redistribute exact copies, is essential on fundamental moral grounds so that you can live an upright ethical life as a good member of your community. If you use a program that lacks freedom number two, then you are in danger of falling into a moral dilemma. At any moment, whenever your friend says, "That program is nice, could I have a copy?" In that moment, you will face a choice between two evils. One evil is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. The other is to refuse your friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. If you are in the dilemma, you ought to choose the lesser evil, which is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. So what makes this the lesser evil? Well, if you can't avoid doing wrong to somebody or other, the least bad is to do it to somebody who deserves it because he has done wrong. Now, we can assume that your friend is a good friend and a good member of your community and normally deserves your cooperation. By contrast, the developer of that proprietary program has deliberately attacked the social solidarity of your community. So if you can't help doing wrong to one or the other, do it to the developer. However, being the lesser evil does not make it good. It's never good to make an agreement and break it, not even when the agreement is inherently evil and keeping it is worse than breaking it, as is the case here. Still, breaking it's not good. And if you give your friend a copy, what will she have? She will have an unauthorized copy of a proprietary program. And that's something rather nasty, almost as nasty as an authorized copy would be. So when you have fully understood this dilemma, what should you really do? You should make sure you never fall into it. I know two ways to do that. One is, don't have any friends. That's what the proprietary software developers implicitly have in mind for you. The other way, my way, is reject proprietary software, specifically reject software without freedom too. So if somebody offers me a program, no matter how attractive it might be, on the condition that I refuse to share it with you, I tell him, my conscience does not permit me to accept that nasty condition. So take your program out of here. I refuse to promise not to share software with you. And you should refuse to promise not to share software with others. Reject software that denies you fundamental freedom too. And reject also the propaganda terms that the proprietary software developers use to demonize the practice of helping other people. Terms like pirate, for instance. Excuse me. So when they call the people who share copies pirates, what are they saying? They're trying to make us accept, without even judging the question, that sharing with other people is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship. And nothing could be more false than that, because attacking ships is very bad, but helping others is good. So don't call them by the same term. Don't call sharing, quote, piracy, unquote. And anytime somebody else does, point out that that shows he's starting from twisted ideas of morality. When people ask me what I think of piracy, I say, attacking ships is very bad. And when they ask what I think of music piracy or software piracy, I say, as far as I've read, pirates don't attack using computers or by playing instruments loud and very badly. Then they'd be called a rock band, I suppose. But instead, they use arms. So their piracy is neither software piracy nor music piracy. It's just piracy. So the point is, I refuse to use their propaganda term with their meaning. You've got to pay attention to this, because if you accept the enemy's propaganda terms, you support their position every time you use them. So that's the reason for freedom, too, the freedom to help others, the freedom to redistribute exact copies when you wish. Freedom zero, the freedom to run your copy as you wish, is essential for a different reason, so that you can control your computing. There are proprietary programs whose licenses restrict how you can use authorized copies. For instance, there is a program for running websites whose license forbids using it to publish anything that criticizes the developer. In this case, a proprietary program literally takes away your freedom of speech. So, freedom zero is obviously essential in order to control your computing. But freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, is not enough, because that's just the freedom to either do or not do whatever the code of the program permits. And that means the developer continues imposing his decisions on you, not through a license, but instead through the code. However, the result is the same. You don't control your computing, he controls it. So you need freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do what you wish. This way you decide instead of letting him decide for you. If you don't have freedom one, then you can't even tell what the program really does. And a lot of these programs have malicious features designed, for instance, to spy on the user, restrict the user. There are even backdoors to attack the user. And not just in obscure, hardly known programs from little companies. One example of a proprietary program which has all three of these malicious kinds of features that you may have heard of is called Microsoft Windows. People have found spy features in it. Of course, the digital restrictions management or digital handcuff features, which restrict what the user can do with his own files in his own computer, those you see. But you don't see the back doors. However, we have discovered two back doors in Windows. One of them allows Microsoft to forcibly install changes in software whenever it wishes. Any software in the machine, Microsoft can change. So anything malicious that Windows does not have today, it could have tomorrow. But that's not the only example. Apple products are really malicious. The Macintosh has digital restrictions management, but the iGrown and the iBad get even worse, because there, Apple has seized power that people otherwise have not been willing to give to anybody over their computers. Apple controls what programs the user can install. Programs can't be installed in those computers, the iGrown and the iBad, unless Apple gives permission specifically for that program. An advance in tyranny. Even worse than what Microsoft does. And then there is the Amazon swindle. Well, its official name is the Kindle, which reflects the purpose of this so-called e-book reader, namely to burn our books. It spies on users because the only place they can buy modern, still copyrighted books is from Amazon, and Amazon keeps track of what books a person buys. So Amazon has a list. Amazon forces the users to identify themselves. So Amazon has a list which of basically of all the books everybody has bought. This list is so dangerous it can't be allowed to exist anywhere. Now, I don't have to claim that I don't have to bring up the question of how trustworthy Amazon is in particular. There is no one in the world that we would dare trust that list to. Now, to attack your freedom to give away books, lend books, and sell books, there are digital restrictions management features. And then there's the back door. We found out about this back door because Amazon used it. Amazon used it to remotely erase all the copies of a particular book that people had bought from Amazon. If there were any unauthorized copies, they may have survived. These were the authorized ones. And the book that Amazon chose to demonstrate the Orwellian nature of this product was 1984 by George Orwell. So this is not a rare, hardly heard of practice. This is the norm. Developers, once they're given the unjust power that proprietary software gives them, they constantly face the temptation to use it to hurt the users in some other way. So what do you do about that? You don't let them have that power in the first place. But even if the developer has the best will in the world and never makes any decision about the code except to serve the users, the fact is, he's still going to make mistakes because he's human. The developers of these programs without Freedom One are human, so they make mistakes and their code has bugs. And the user of a program without Freedom One is equally helpless facing an accidental error as facing a deliberate malicious feature. If you use a program lacking Freedom One, you are a prisoner of your software. Now, we free software developers are human too, and our free software code also has mistakes, also has bugs. But if you find a bug in our code or anything in our code that you don't like, you are free to change it because we did not make you a prisoner. We can't be perfect. We can respect your freedom. So Freedom One is essential. But it's not enough, because that's the freedom to personally study and change the source code. That's not enough because there are millions of users that don't know how to program, and they're not in a position to exercise Freedom One. But even for programmers like me, Freedom One's not enough because there is so much software in the world. There's so much free software already that no user is capable of personally studying the source code of all the programs she uses and then personally writing all the changes she might want, because that's more work than one human being is capable of doing. So the only way we can fully have control of our computing is by working together. And for that, we need freedom three, the freedom to contribute to your community, the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions to others when you wish. With that, we don't all have to write every change for ourselves, one by one. It's enough to write the change once and then publish the modified version, and other people then can use it too. So if some people release a free program and we use it because we like it, but we wish it had certain improvements, somebody can start with that version and implement part of the improvements and release his modified version. And somebody else can start with that and implement some more of these changes and release her modified version. And then some others can start with that and finish the job and release their modified version. And then we'll thank them all and switch to it because it does what we want. So with Freedom 3, the changes only have to be written once and then they can be distributed to others so that we can all benefit. Now, I should point out, Freedom 3, just like the others, is not a requirement. None of these four freedoms is a requirement. If a program is free software, you're free to run it as you wish. You're not required to run it. You're not required to run it as you wish. You could be a masochist and run it the way you don't wish. You're free to do that too. Freedom 1, the freedom to study and change the source code, you're not required to. You can just run it without ever looking at the source code. You don't have to exercise freedom one. And freedom two, the freedom to redistribute exact copies. Well, you're not required to. The point is you're free to do so if and when you wish. And likewise with freedom three, if you've made a modified version, you're not required to distribute copies to anyone. The point is you've got to be free to do so if you choose to. And the four freedoms together benefit all users, and all users get the benefits of the four freedoms. Every user can exercise freedoms 0 and 2, the freedom to run the program as you wish, and the freedom to redistribute exact copies. These freedoms don't require programming, so everybody knows how to do them. Freedoms 1 and 3, the freedom to study and change the source code, and then optionally to distribute copies of your modified version, these entail programming. So any given user is more or less capable of exercising these freedoms, depending on how much he knows how to program. And of course, most people don't learn how to program, so they can't directly exercise these freedoms. But when others who do know how exercise these freedoms, and when they publish their modified versions, everybody can then install them or not, as they wish. And so we all get the benefit of living in a community where everybody has these freedoms. And the four freedoms together give us democracy. A free program develops democratically under the control of its users, because every user is free to participate in society's decision about the future of the program, which is simply the sum of all the users' decisions of what to do with it. By contrast, a proprietary program develops under the dictatorship of its developer. The developer has sole control, total control. So in effect, the program is simply an instrument to give him power over the users. And most of the time, that's what all he wants anyway. He doesn't care about the program as such. He only cares about the power it's going to give him over some people, so he can then bully them, exploit them, and abuse them. So society has a choice to make. On one side, we have individual freedom, social solidarity, and democracy. And on the other, we have the dictatorship of whoever controls the program. And the users have to live under the unjust power of whoever has that control. Society must choose free software, and get rid of non-free software. And schools must play their part. Schools must teach exclusively free software. And there are four reasons for this. The most obvious is to save money, because even in wealthy countries, the schools don't have enough money. So they shouldn't waste a part of their limited budgets paying for permission to run a non-free program. Now, this reason is obvious and superficial. Even people who don't really understand what free software is all about, who think it means gratis software instead of freedom-respecting software, they'll still see the benefit of saving money. But on the other hand, if they don't understand what the issue's all about, they'll never get the point. So it's really important not to focus mainly on this benefit. This is sort of the thing to attract people's interest so that they can find out what really matters. And besides, there are some proprietary software developers that have a habit of eliminating this reason by donating gratis copies of their non-free software to schools. And why do they do that? They're trying to use the schools as instruments to impose dependence on society. Here's how their plan works. They give these gratis copies to the school, and the school teaches their students how to use them, and they develop a dependence. Then they graduate. And after they graduate, the same developer does not give them gratis copies. And they go to work for companies. The developer does not offer those companies gratis copies. So the idea is, if the school will go along with this and will direct its students down the path of dependence, then they can draw the rest of society along with them. Exactly. This is like giving the school gratis needles full of drugs, saying, inject these into your students. The first dose is gratis. Once you're dependent, then you have to pay. The schools would reject these addictive drugs, and they should reject the gratis copies of non-free software, just as they'd reject the paid-for copies of non-free software, because the school has a social mission, and that is to educate the next generation as good citizens of a strong, capable, cooperating, independent, and free society. And in computing, that means teaching people to be free software users, teaching them how to be citizens of that society. So schools must completely refuse to teach their students how to use proprietary software, because that is spreading dependence. But there's a deeper reason. For the sake of the education of the best programmers, the natural-born programmers, the people who, 10 to 13 years old, are fascinated and want to learn everything about how the software does what it does. Because when these people ask the teacher, how does this program do this? If it's proprietary, the teacher can only say, I'm sorry, it's a secret. We're not allowed to find out. And that means education cannot even begin. But if it's free, the teacher can explain as much as he knows and then say, here's the source code of this program. Read it and you'll understand everything. And that kid will read it because that kid's fascinated and yearns to understand everything. And the teacher can say, if you come across anything you can't figure out, show it to me and we'll figure it out together. This gives our natural-born programmer the chance to learn something very important. That part of the code is not clear, so don't write it that way. You got to learn a lot of those to become a good programmer in practice. You see, the natural-born programmers don't have to be taught to program. They just have to read a manual and they say, oh, of course, that's what programming is. But programming well is something else. The way you learn to write good, clear code is by reading lots of code and writing lots of code. Only free software gives you the chance to read lots of code of real programs that people really use. And only free software gives you the chance to learn to write code well for large programs Because the way to learn to write the code for large programs is by starting small. But that does not mean writing small programs, because in small programs, you don't even begin to encounter the difficulties of large ones. So the only way you can start small is by writing small amounts of code for large programs, obviously existing large programs. And only free software gives you the chance to do that. This is how people have to learn to be programmers who write code for large programs and do a good job of it. Any school that wants to offer this opportunity, and that means any school at least that's teaching students above age 10, had better be a free software school so that the students have a chance. But there's an even deeper reason. For the sake of moral education, education in citizenship, schools must teach not just facts and skills. They must teach the spirit of goodwill, the habit of helping other people. So every class must have the following rule. Students, if you bring software to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share it with the rest of the class. And you must present the source code, too, in case someone would like to learn, because this is a place where we share our knowledge. However, the school has to set a good example by following its own rule. The school also must share copies with the rest of the class, and that must include the source code. The school must only bring free software to class. This university must only teach free software, which means you have work to do. You've got to get this university to stop running proprietary software for the use of its students. Stop asking them to ever run any proprietary software. Because anytime it does that, it betrays the social mission of the school. Proprietary software is the enemy of the spirit of education. It should never be tolerated in a school. So how do you get there? Well, the first step is join up and work together. Don't just do it by yourself. Look for every ally you can find. Always raise the issue in moral terms. Don't let other people sidetrack you into superficial side issues only, because there's something more important at stake here. And as a student, there's something you personally can do. When you go into the first meeting of a class, ask during the class, "Professor, will this class expect me to run any non-free software?" And if the answer is, if it's not clear, then discuss it to find out. But if the answer turns out to be yes, then say, "Still, in the class, my conscience does not permit me to use non-free software. Can we please work out a way I can demonstrate my knowledge of the material of this class using free software, and I don't mind if it takes me extra time and extra work, because I'm willing to make that sacrifice to do things right." It's hard for a teacher to say no to a student who's asking for the permission to do extra work. And if the teacher does say no, well, say, "I'll be back, I'll try again next year." Take a different class. The point is, you have to be willing to push with every ounce of stubbornness that you can summon up. And if you're not alone, that makes it even more effective. It's not hard to migrate a school to free software if you do it in several years. I'm not saying they should do it this week. That would make it That would make a lot of unnecessary difficulties. In 5 years, it's not that hard. It just takes will. So that is a very brief version of my talk about free software. Well, I wouldn't normally have said so much about the topic at the beginning of this speech, which is about copyright versus community. But as I said, it seemed really important to do this. But this topic responds to a question people used to ask me sometimes at the end of a speech about free software. They would say, well, do these ideas apply to anything other than software? Like, what about hardware? Should hardware be free too? Well, remember, I've defined precisely what free means. It refers to these four freedoms. So what would it mean for a piece of hardware to be free in this sense? It would mean that it gives you the four freedoms. Well, is that feasible? Look at freedom zero. That's normally the freedom to run the program as you wish. We'd have to adapt that into the freedom to use the piece of the physical object the way you wish. And lo and behold, you'd normally have that freedom. The manufacturers of physical objects don't put license conditions on them when they sell them to you. If you bought it, you're now free to use it however you like. So you've got freedom zero. What about freedom one? Well, here we hit a snag. That's the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do what you wish. Well, there's no source code for a physical object. So we have to adapt it. We could make it the freedom to study and change the object itself. That at least makes sense. And you have that freedom, except that for a lot of physical objects, it's rather hard to exercise that freedom. The possibilities of doing so are rather limited. Now, if you have a wooden chair or a car from 1960, there are some considerable possibilities of changing that object. But on the other hand, if you have a chip, there's nothing you can do to change it. Any attempt would only destroy it. So the answer is you've got freedom one, but practically speaking, the exercise of it can be rather limited. What about freedom two, the freedom to redistribute copies of the physical object to others? Well, for most physical objects, there are no copiers. I guess the only ones that we commonly find copiers for are keys. Although, in a sense, agricultural plants and animals can be copied, although not exactly. And that is a real political issue as the multinational corporations try to crush farmers' freedom to do that. But that's a very special case. There are no copiers for computers or microphones or chairs or tables. So for most physical objects, freedom too is simply a totally theoretical practical irrelevancy. And likewise, freedom three. If you've managed to modify a physical object, there's still no copiers, so you can't hand out copies of your version. So the answer is physical objects, they are free to the extent that it's feasible with today's technology. And the issue doesn't really exist. But there are other things which we can copy and modify. And therefore, the question of to what extent we're free to do so is a real and important question. And those are other kinds of works made out of information, made up of information, which you might have a copy of in your computer, and then you could use your computer to copy them and modify them. So that's the issue I'm speaking about. Now, for the most part, if you don't have these freedoms for something other than software, that's because copyright law took them away. So the same question, should you be free to do these things with your copies of published works, can be phrased from the other direction as, what should copyright law say about them? Now, to think about this, it's useful to look at the history of copyright and the history of copying technology, which are closely linked. changes in technology cannot affect basic moral principles. Those are too deep to be touched by technological changes. But when we apply our principles to a specific question, we do it by looking at the various things we might do and then at their consequences and then judging those. So a change in the context can alter the consequences of the same act and thus make it more good or more bad than it was before. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, then murder wouldn't be so bad. The judge would say, you killed him, you're going to have to pay for his new body, bang, and okay. Now, in civilized countries, of course, the National Health Service would generally pay for this, but in the U.S. we would need to get uninsured murderer insurance. So, let's look at the history of copying technology. Copying began in the ancient world, where it was done with a writing instrument on a writing surface. You would read some of the book and you would write a copy of that. This technology was very inefficient, but it had certain other interesting characteristics. First of all, it had no economy of scale. To make 10 copies would take you 10 times as long as making one copy. Second, it required no special equipment other than the equipment for reading and writing. Third, it required no special skill other than literacy itself. The result was a decentralized production of copies. Copies of any book would be made wherever there was a copy and somebody wanted more.
Actually, ancient scribes typically were illiterate.
I doubt that. It may have been true somewhere, but I'm skeptical.
That's a pretty well-known. Typically, they knew what a letter A was, they knew what a letter B was, but they didn't know what the joined.
May have been true somewhere. May have been true somewhere. But I'd be interested to see what you can show me about that. But in any case, anyone who did know how to read could also copy just as well as anyone else could. Now, in the ancient world, there was nothing like copyright. If you had a copy of a book and you wanted to copy it, no one was going to try to stop you, except in the case where the local ruler didn't like what the book said, in which case he might do all sorts of horrible things to you, which was not exactly copyright, however, but censorship, something that has been closely related to copyright. However, then there was a big advance in copying technology, the printing press, which made copying a lot more efficient, but not uniformly so. Because in the ancient world, mass production copying and one-off copying were both slow. Well, with the printing press, mass production copying got a lot more efficient, but making one copy at a time didn't get any more efficient because it was faster to do that by hand than with the printing press. So the printing press, it turns out, had an economy of scale. To set the type took a lot of time, but then you could quickly make many identical copies off that. Also, the press and the type were expensive equipment that most people who could read and write did not own. And the skill to use it was different from the skill of reading and writing. So most literate people didn't know how to run a printing press. The result was centralized production of copying. So copies were made of any given book were made in a few places, and then they were transported to places somebody might want to buy them. For the first few centuries of printing, a large fraction of books were still made by hand, by writing them. They were either done for very rich people or to show how rich they were, or by poor people, because as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. I'm still waiting for that song to become popular again. I thought it would be this year. Well, maybe it still will. So there were poor people who couldn't afford to buy a printed copy, but they had the time on their hands to write a copy. Now, copyright began in the age of the printing press. Copyright in England started as a system of censorship. That is, in order to get permission to print a book, you'd have to apply to the government, which would, and if it approved the book, it would give a perpetual monopoly to one publisher. However, and this was, I think, 1550-something, but the system of censorship eventually became obsolete and was allowed to lapse in the 1680s. And the publishers wanted their monopoly back, but what they were able to get was something different because people had a bright idea of giving the copyright to the author instead. And the idea arose that copyright could be a system to encourage writing. When the U.S. Constitution was drawn up, there was a proposal that authors should be entitled to a copyright. This was rejected. What was adopted instead says, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the exclusive use of their respective writings and discoveries. Now, we can see a few things from this. First of all, the Constitution does not require any system of copyright. It doesn't say there shall be, that authors shall have this exclusive use. It just says Congress has the power to do it if it wishes. It's not required to. Second, the purpose is clearly stated. It's not for the benefit of copyright holders. It's to promote progress, which is a benefit for the public. And the third point is that copyright has to last for a limited time. Ever since that decision was made, the publishers have been trying to convince us to forget it was made. But copyright in the age of the printing press operated as an industrial regulation on publishers, controlled by authors, and set up to provide benefits to the public. It operated as an industrial regulation because it only restricted the things that publishers could do. Sorry, it only restricted the things that if you did them made you a publisher. It didn't restrict the things that ordinary readers did. And people kept on making copies by hand, but nobody tried to stop them using copyright law because it was supposed to be an industrial regulation. As a result, it was uncontroversial, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. It was uncontroversial because the readers had nothing to complain about. They were not being restricted in anything they could do. They had nothing to object to. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced on publishers. And it's easy to find out who's publishing a book. You go to a bookstore and you say, where do these copies come from? It doesn't require invading everyone's home and everyone's computer. And it was arguably beneficial because the public, according to the traditional U.S. understanding of copyright law, traded away part of its natural rights to copy anything and in exchange received benefits, the benefits of more writing. Now, trading away the freedom to copy was no loss to people who didn't have the means to copy. And that's what made the copyright bargain, as it was generally called, a positive deal for the readers. They were trading away notional freedoms that they had no ability to exercise. So practically speaking, what they lost was of no use to them. And if we were still in the age of the printing press, I don't think I would be making a fuss about it even now. But the printing press technology is gradually giving way to another advance in copying technology, digital information technology, which makes it a lot easier to copy and manipulate information. It's a further advance beyond what we had in the age of the printing press. Once again, it makes copying more efficient, and once again, not uniformly more efficient, because it gives us a situation like this, where both mass production and one-off copying have benefited, but one-off copying has benefited a lot more. So now the difference between them is not so much, which means that qualitatively this is more like the ancient world. We're making one copy at a time was feasible compared with mass production. Now, it's true that making copies one at a time is often not quite as cheap as, you know, per copy as mass producing them. For instance, one-off CDs cost more than mass-produced CDs, and they're less robust, but they're cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people can make them. So the result is that the freedom that we used to trade away and not miss it, now we can exercise it, and we want to, so we must have it back. So what would a democratic government... So effectively, this means that even if copyright laws text had not changed at all, its effect would be different. It used to have the effect of an industrial regulation because it only restricted publishers. But now that we all have the means to copy, it has turned into a restriction on each and every person. So it's no longer uncontroversial, it's no longer easy to enforce, and it's no longer beneficial. It's no longer uncontroversial because the readers are being restricted and they don't like it. It's no longer easy to enforce because it's no longer just to be enforced on publishers. To enforce copyright against each and every one of us leads the enforcers to plan to invade our homes and our computers, and they keep finding new ways to do this. And it's not beneficial because the freedom that we traded away is now too useful. We've got to have it back. So what would a democratic government do? It would change this. It would say, we've given the publishers effectively too much power over the general public. This has got to be fixed. The copyright powers have got to be reduced. We can gauge the lack of democracy around the world by the tendency in almost every country to do the exact opposite, to make copyright stricter, more powerful as a restriction on the public than it was in the age of the printing press. This can be seen in the dimension of time. In the US, the duration of copyright has been extended several times in the past decades. The last time was in 1998, when copyright was extended by 20 years on both past and future works. Now, it's hard to understand. Supposedly this was done, and the law says that its purpose is to make more of an incentive for the production of new works. But how extending the copyright on past works could motivate the authors of the past to write more back then is hard for me to grasp. And even if they have a time machine, it seems they haven't used it, because our history books don't record that there was a big burst of writing activity starting in 1923, because the authors of the time just found out that their copyrights would be extended in 1998. Now, extending the copyright on future works is not quite so absurd. It's at least conceivable that somebody might be motivated to write something or paint or sing something because of 20 more years of copyright. But only if this person is quite irrational. because the discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright, perhaps a century in the future after you're dead, is so small that it's not going to motivate a rational person to change any decision. So what was the real reason for this law? All that was just bullshit excuses. As we know, Congress sells laws to companies that are willing to pay enough. And companies like Disney were aware that they had lucrative monopolies that were scheduled to end, like the monopoly on the character Mickey Mouse. The first film in which Mickey Mouse appeared was going to go into the public domain soon. Disney has got a lot from the public domain and intends never to give anything back. So it paid for a law to extend its copyrights by 20 more years. And I suppose probably some other companies paid for it too. So the movie companies say they want perpetual copyright, but even they can't, they don't have the power yet to get an amendment passed to the Constitution. So they worked out another way to get the same effective result, perpetual copyright on the installment plan. Every 20 years, extend copyright by 20 more years so that no copyrights will ever expire, but no copyrights are nominally perpetual. At any given time, for any given work, there's a date when it will supposedly go into the public domain. But that date is like tomorrow, it never comes. By the time you get there, they will have postponed it. And so we can expect that in 2018 or so, there will be an attempt to add 20 more years if we don't stop them. Well, time is one dimension, but what about breadth? Which uses should copyright cover? Now, in the age of the printing press, copyright did not cover and was not intended to cover all uses of a copyrighted work. Because the uses that were covered by and restricted by copyright were the exceptions within a broader space of free usage. However, the publishers have looked at digital technology and they recognize in it the opportunity to impose on us a pay-per-view universe. And they're trying to do that with DRM, Digital Restrictions Management. So these are the malicious features that restrict what people can do with their own files in their own computer. The first place the public saw this was in movies, because the movie on a DVD is stored in an encrypted format, which was originally a secret. The purpose of the secret was to restrict the public. It was a conspiracy of companies to restrict the public's access to technology, and they made everyone who wanted to manufacture a DVD player agree to build it to restrict the public just like all the other DVD players. And originally this conspiracy worked fine for them, but then people figured out the format and released a free program capable of decrypting the movie so you could actually watch the movie on the DVD using free software. So then the movie companies and their friends purchased another law in the US in 1998 establishing censorship of software capable of doing that. That was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I couldn't hear you. Yeah. Well, he's the first so-called Democrat that was so right-wing I couldn't support him. So, and that those laws have been extended to many other countries. The U.S.'s highest priority in trade negotiations is to impose censorship on other countries. However, even though this software is illegal, it's easy to get, and the movie companies realized they couldn't make it go away. So they developed another follow-on scheme of digital restrictions management called AACS. And that's what's used in Blu-ray discs and was used in HD DVD discs. They thought that would never be broken. A few years ago, I saw someone had published a free program to decrypt AACS, but it was useless. It was legal because it didn't actually work. Because in order to do anything, you had to have the key, and no one knew that. And then I saw a photo of two adorable little puppies. And on top of them were 32 hex digits above them. You know, and why put these two things together? I wonder if those numbers are some important key. And the point is to prevent that knowledge from being suppressed by putting it together with these cute puppies so people would copy it just because they like the puppies without understanding what was so important. And that's what it was. That was the key to break the axe. And it was posted on Dig, and the editors obedient servants of the empire, deleted it. And it was posted again, and they deleted it. And after a few hundred times, they said, "We give up." After a couple of weeks, this was found on 700,000 web pages that were indexed. So this was a big outpouring of hostility to DRM, but that didn't mean final victory. They just changed the key. Meanwhile, Blu-ray has another layer of DRM. And I don't know if anyone has ever produced free software that can get past that.
We have, but it's not free.
So there's no free software.
Yeah,
it's too bad. Meanwhile, I've read that it's possible to make Blu-ray discs which don't have DRM, which makes them 100% vicious. You know, you can write a DRM that doesn't have... They don't allow people to make Blu-ray discs without digital... So there is no... ...not be tolerated. Nothing can excuse them. Because you must never use any product designed to attack your freedom unless you have the means to defeat the attack. So it's okay to use DVDs if you have the free software to play them with. Otherwise, you should refuse to use DVDs that are encrypted. And that's what I do. I don't have that program, and I don't have or use any encrypted DVDs. I just refuse them. Part of the reason for that is I sometimes go to France, and in France, one can be imprisoned for merely having a copy of this program. That shows how far these evil governments are willing to go to attack their citizens on behalf of these powerful corporations. So that's the situation with video. But we've also seen DRM in music. Starting about 10 years ago, things came out that looked like compact discs, but they didn't fit the specs for compact discs. They weren't written right. So we referred to them as corrupt discs. And they were being written wrong so that computers couldn't read them. That was the goal. So we had to be on the lookout for these and warn people not to buy them. But in some countries, they have to be labeled differently. If they were not written as regular compact discs, they couldn't use the compact disc logo. So they had a different symbol which says copy control. I once gave a speech on this topic in Spain. I'd been invited by a regional government agency. So, of course, they afterwards gave me some books and some records from their region. And one of the records was by a musician I'd heard of, so I wanted to play it. But fortunately, before I opened the door, it said, copy control. This record can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems. In other words, only with proprietary software. So I handed it back and I said, here you see the face of the enemy. Please take this back to the store because they don't deserve to keep your money. So I've never heard that record and I probably never will. I'm sorry for that musician who had digital handcuffs attached to his record, but I'm not going to give up my freedom for a mere desire to hear some music. Anyway, Sony had a very clever idea for making corrupt discs. They made the discs, put them into a computer, they would install some software into the computer. In fact, the software that they installed was like a virus or what crackers use to break the security. It's called a rootkit, which meant that it took control of the computer and made changes in the system. And of course, among the changes it made was stuff to restrict what you could do with what you read off their records. But more than that, it also altered some of the commands you would use to examine what was inside the system so that you wouldn't be able to detect the presence of these changes. And it altered another command you would use to delete these changes so that it would be a no-op. Now, all this is a felony. But it's not the only felony Sony committed, because part of this software included some free software that had been released under the GNU General Public License. And they did not follow the conditions which say that the entire program containing that code had to be released under the same GNU GPL. And that users had to be offered source code, given a copy of the GNU GPL to tell them their rights. Sony didn't do any of that. That's commercial copyright infringement. A bunch of them could have gone to jail for this, but they were never really in any danger because the prosecutors understood that the purpose of laws is to subject us to the megacorporations, not to limit them. So they were never prosecuted, but people did sue them. Unfortunately, the people who were angry focused their condemnation not on the malicious purpose of this feature, but only on the other nasty things that Sony used as part of the means to achieve that malicious purpose. Therefore, Sony was able to settle the suit by promising that in the future, when it designed systems to attack our freedom, it wouldn't do these other nasty things as part of the method. And Sony has learned its lesson, because in the future, the rootkit will be installed in the computer before you get it, and it will be impossible to remove. And it will be AACS, and the computer will be the PlayStation 3. Although I heard that just recently people have managed to crack the DRM on that. That took a long time. In any case, DRM on music is mostly gone. Now, I'm told that this happened because the major record companies signed a deal with Apple, and they didn't understand how bad it was going to be for them. And once they saw how disadvantageous it was, they said, we've got to get out of this. But the only other way they could sell any music not through Apple was to do it without DRM. So they said, oh, well, we hate to do it, but we'll do it. And they tried it, and it wasn't so bad, so they did it. It got them out from under the control by Apple that they found so painful. So Apple wants to claim credit for this. it may be indirectly responsible, but not in a way that does it any credit. However, we're seeing renewed attempts to impose DRM on books. The purpose of e-books is to take away the traditional freedoms of readers, freedoms to do things like lend a book to your friend or borrow it from the public library, to sell a book to a used bookstore or to buy it anonymously paying cash, and even the freedom to keep the book for as long as you wish and read it as many times as you wish and eventually pass it on to your children. All these freedoms they want to take away from us, but there are too many people who read books and would object to any law taking away these freedoms for books. So they came up with a two-stage plan to get the effectively same result, and that is, first, take away these freedoms for e-books, which they did in 1998 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, back when there were no e-books and nobody except people like me was thinking about the question. And the second stage is convince people to switch from printed books to e-books. And they're still working on that. They tried that about 10 years ago. There was tremendous hype about e-books. It had to be funded. So I'm sure there was an organized PR campaign to convince everyone that they would read e-books. And then they started actually publishing the e-books. And one publisher had an idea that it could start off its line of encrypted user-restricting e-books with a bang if it started with a biography of me. So they found an author, and the author approached me and asked if I would cooperate, and I said, only if this book is published without encryption. And if people can copy it, you know. So at that point, he went back to the publisher, and the publisher said, absolutely not. And eventually he found another publisher who permitted this, and not only that, but permitted the books text to be released under a free license, the GNU Free Documentation License. So it got written and published and sold a lot of copies on paper too. So what this means is I resisted the temptation to try to get my message out there by blatantly contradicting it and turning myself into a hypocrite. And it's, when I put it that way, it sounds obviously stupid. But so many people give in to that temptation. You've got to remind them, you're not going to persuade people by acting like a hypocrite. So ebooks basically failed in the beginning of the last decade. And I said, they're going to try again. And that's what is happening with the Amazon swindle and the Sony shredder and all those other malicious products. Their purpose is to take away our freedom. Don't accept any e-books that restrict you beyond what you're allowed to do with printed books. Anyway, you may have noticed I mentioned that DRM is typically set up by a conspiracy of companies. It's rare that one company alone is in a position to even try. It takes a conspiracy, typically between publishers and technology companies, and often many of them. For instance, but the point is, you might ask, how I know? How do I know about these conspiracies? They're not secret. They have websites. For instance, AACS has a website on which I read the rules that they demand manufacturers follow. In particular, one thing they said was starting in 2011, it would be forbidden to make any analog video outputs. The reason is they want to, quote, close the analog hole, unquote. Let me show you a couple of analog holes that they would like to plug, I'm sure. It also states which companies initially launched the conspiracy, and they included Microsoft and Apple and Intel and AMD and Philips and I think IBM, and I don't remember the other two. But I suppose it's still there. You see, a conspiracy to restrict the public's access to technology ought to be a felony, like a conspiracy to restrict prices. But they know that our government is on their side against us. So they have no fear at all of being prosecuted. And they just boast of their conspiracies to attack our freedom. And because DRM is typically established in such an organized way, we need to organize to fight back. So we started the Defective by Design campaign, which you can find in defectivebydesign.org. Please visit the site and join in our protests, because the mission is to show companies, some of them very large, that if they attack our freedom, if they design their products to attack our freedom, they will be hated. We need a lot of support to achieve this mission. Please visit defectivebydesign.org and sign up. Well, this is what is being done to copyright law by governments that don't care much about our freedom. But what would a democratic government do? It would reduce copyright power. Well, how? First, there's the dimension of time. Copyright lasts far too long. It should be reduced to last, I propose, 10 years from the date of publication of a work. Now, why from the date of publication? Because before the work is published, we don't have copies, so it has no effect on us whether what we're allowed to do with the copies we don't have. So we might as well let the author have as long as it takes to arrange publication and then start the clock. Why 10 years? Well, the publication cycle is getting shorter and shorter. Nowadays, in the U.S., almost all books are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within three. Well, 10 years is more than three times that. So it seems comfortably plenty. But I'm not saying that 10 years is the exact right amount of time. I'm just suggesting it is a first adjustment. And then we could wait a while and adjust it up or down. And there are people who disagree with this, of course. For instance, I once proposed these same things in a panel discussion with fiction writers. And the award-winning fantasy writer to my side said, 10 years, that's absolutely wrong. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Yeah, it surprised me too. And the reason is I had been led astray by what the publishers say. You see, when the publishers demand more power over us, they always say they're doing it for the authors. It's on behalf of it's the authors who need to have more power. And they don't mention that almost all authors basically hand the power over to the publishers, so that the publishers really are the ones who get to exercise it. And typically, the publishers will bring out a few very famous authors and artists who, because of their fame, really do get benefits from the copyrights on their work. And those famous people say, yes, we want more power over the public, and we're invited to assume that it's the same for all the other authors and artists, but actually it's not. Actually, those same publishers are grinding them into the ground with their heels all the time. At the same time that in their name they're demanding more power over us, they're abusing them. So this writer had a dispute with his publisher. You see, his contract said that if the book went out of print, the rights would revert to him. But it appeared that his book was out of print, but the author wouldn't admit it. And the author was using the copyright on his own book to stop him from distributing copies of it, which he wanted to do so that people could read it. There were people who wanted to get his book and read it, and they couldn't get it. So he wanted to give them copies. And the publisher, who wouldn't give them copies, was using his own copyright to stop him. He realized that more than 5 years of copyright was unlikely to ever do him any good, but it could do him harm. So he said anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Well, I'm not necessarily against only 5 years. I'm suggesting 10 years because I'm being a little more cautious. Well, that's one dimension, but what about the other, that of breadth? Which activities should copyright cover? I think that varies depending on the sort of work it is. And I've distinguished three categories of works for which I recommend different treatment. One category is that of works that you use to do a practical job, functional works. Another category is works whose purpose, whose contribution to society is they tell you what specific people thought. And the third category is works of art and entertainment, where the contribution that they make is in the impact of the work itself. So for these three categories, I have different recommendations. The works of functional, practical use, these have to be free. And that makes sense because software is a part of this category. But there are other things in it too, like recipes. And notice how people who cook are accustomed to redistributing recipes and changing recipes, and they can distribute their changed versions of recipes. In fact, it's the same four freedoms that they already effectively live with. And that's no coincidence. If you use a work to do a job in your life, you need the four freedoms. Because if you don't control the work, then you don't control your life. Freedom is having control of your own life. So these works need to be free. In addition, this category includes educational works, reference works, text fonts, and various other things you might think of. And they all must be free with the same four freedoms. But someone might object, but if we don't give up our freedom and let these publishers control us, then the works won't get made at all, and our life will be a disaster. So let's give up our freedom right away. Well, of course, it's never good to be in a rush to give up your freedom in panic. Because, you know, people who would like to take it away from you, they're really good at making things look bad and making you panic. But 20 years ago, we didn't have evidence to prove that they were wrong. Today we do. If we look at all the free software that we're using, it shows lots of works will get made. And then look at all the recipes which cooks are circulating. And then let's look at reference works such as Wikipedia. So we can see that, and even free textbooks are starting to exist, although that is not as advanced as the other fields. If you write anything useful as a textbook or a part of one, make it free. It's important. But there are some already. Look at freetextbookproject.org. So nowadays we can see that it isn't necessary to give up our freedom in order to have any works to use. So we shouldn't panic, and we should stand firm for our freedom. But there are the other categories. What about the works that say what somebody thought? These include autobiographies, essays of opinion, scientific papers, and some other things as well. Well, to publish a modified version of them is just to misrepresent someone else. I don't think that's much of a contribution to society. So there's no imperative for people to be allowed to do that. So what I recommend is a somewhat reduced copyright system which would cover all commercial use and all modification. But everyone would be free to non-commercially share exact copies of these published works. And that is the minimum freedom that we must have in order to eliminate the injustice of today's copyright. The injustice of today's copyright comes from the war on sharing, the attempt to attack and crush the practice of sharing with other people. Well, that's the non-commercial sharing of exact copies. So if we legalize that, copyright once again becomes something we can live with. And this somewhat reduced copyright system will continue providing revenue to the authors in more or less the same inadequate way as today. Usually inadequate, that is, because there are occasional exceptions. And what about works of art and entertainment? For them, the question of modification was difficult for me because there are valid arguments on both sides. On the one hand, an artistic work could have an artistic integrity which modification could destroy. However, artistic integrity is much rarer among artists than they might claim. Look at how ready they are to let Hollywood butcher these works in exchange for a lot of money. But on the other hand, there are some writers who won't let Hollywood butcher their work and insist that the movie reflect faithfully the book. They may have had some artistic integrity. In any case, I think it is possible that concept is meaningful. But on the other hand, modifying an artistic work can be a contribution to art. Consider the folk process, by which a series of artists can transform a work, and this can produce something very rich and beautiful. But if we want to consider only named writers, consider Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays used stories that were copied from other works that had been published a few decades before. If today's copyright law had existed then, those plays would have been illegal, they would have been infringing, so they would never have been written. And if the copyright holders said, well, I'm glad they were never written, they would just be cheap ripoffs of our great works, then since we would not have ever seen them, we would have no basis to say with confidence that that's false. On the other hand, we do say that Shakespeare was a great writer and some of those plays were important contributions to human literature. So, how do I reconcile this? Eventually I realized that though modifying an artistic work can be a contribution to art, it's not desperately urgent. If you are using a work to do a practical job in your life, you've got to be free to change it today, if you're going to do the job today. And then you've got to be free to publish it, your version right away, because there may be other people trying to do the same job who would benefit from your version. But with art, it's good to be able to publish your version, but it's okay if you have to wait 10 years for the copyright to expire. 10 years is not forever. One can wait 10 years. And because it's just an aesthetic goal rather than a practical need, we can live with that. So what I recommend is for 10 years, the same somewhat reduced copyright system that covers all commercial use and all modified versions, but we will all be free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies of any published work, which is the minimum freedom we must always have for any kind of work that is published. So that's basically what I recommend, but I do want to mention another issue, which is that of remix, which consists of taking little bits of a lot of work and a lot of different works and putting them together into something that's totally different. Now, if the purpose of copyright is to promote authorship, this just has to be legal. To let copyright restrict this in any way is to forget completely about its purpose And the only reason that that happens is because the publishers don't care about that purpose. They only care, they don't care about promoting progress of anything. They only care about promoting their pocketbooks. So, in particular, this means sharing copies on the internet must be legalized. Any attempt to stop people from sharing is an attack on society. It must not be tolerated. Those who seek to do this take the side of the multinational entertainment industries against the citizens. But they say, if you share, you're just stealing from the artists. Well, you know, I buy commercial CDs, and whenever I do, I'm ashamed to know I'm not supporting the artists, because I know they're not going to get any money from what I pay. Because the only musicians who get any money when you buy their CDs are long-established superstars and not on their early records. You see, other than that, the contracts the record companies sign with musicians are horribly exploitative. There is a fraction of the purchase price, which supposedly is for the musicians, but they're never going to get it, because the contract says that the publicity and production expenses are treated as advances to the musicians, and the money you pay just goes to, quote, repay the advance, unquote, which means it goes from one account in the record company to another, but the musicians will never get any. Now, this is not just a small amount of money. I saw examples of how this would work out. A record can even go platinum without starting to give the musicians any money when it gets sold. What this means is the way the musicians get their money is through other things, through concerts and through selling merchandise at their concerts. That's how they make money. And the benefit they get from their record contracts is that they get more concerts and more people come to those concerts. So after all, the publicity does them some good. But there are healthier ways to give them publicity, ways that are not controlled by money. We've got to get the hype industrial complex out of music, not just for our own freedom's sake, but even for the health of music. So the reason why the long-established superstars get money when you buy their records, their newer records, is when the first contract expires after 5 or 7 albums, then if you're a superstar, all the record companies will beg you to sign with them, and you can demand a contract that will really give you some money. But those are very few. And meanwhile, the earlier records, the record company that controls them is going to keep on doing that. So you still won't get any money for those. So the result is it's a system that works so badly that there's not much to be lost. And people might wonder about movies. Would it still be possible to make movies if people were free to share? After all, you've heard the tremendous amounts of money that movies supposedly cost. A producer told me more than half of those figures is usually publicity, not actually making the movie. And even that part has been inflated by creative accounting, because that, by inflating it, the studio gets to keep more of the money. So they don't cost as much as you might think. And meanwhile, a lot of use of movies is commercial use, which would be covered by this system just as it is today. You know, showing it in theaters is is commercial, showing it in airplanes is commercial, broadcasting it on TV is commercial. So there's a lot of commercial use from which they would still get the money. And of course they can sell copies to and people will pay for them. So I'm pretty sure they can still make movies. But I don't think it's such an important question. And the reason is that Hollywood systematically makes crap. I read a book which was interesting to me, although not for the reason this author had in mind. It was called Save the Cat. And the book purported to be advice on how to write screenplays so that they would sell. But what was interesting for me was that it explained the systematic reasons why Hollywood makes crap. It's not because they're all incompetent and they're all trying to do better, but it comes out as crap. No, the system makes it be crap. They say you can't possibly sell a screenplay unless there is a description of it in one line. So, does that matter? Well, I certainly don't want to censor anything just because I think it's crap. Censorship is evil. There is nothing that can justify censorship. But that's not the question. The question is rather, should we give up our freedom to help them continue making crap? And that I'm not in favor of. On the other hand, even if legalizing sharing doesn't make a big decrease in the support for the arts, we might want to increase our support for the arts. We might want a better system than the existing one. So I have a few to suggest. That is, a better system meaning one that supports the arts better than the existing one, and preferably more efficiently too. That is, doing more with using our money more efficiently to support the arts. Because the existing system supports a lot of executives and a few superstars, but doesn't support most of the artists adequately even. So here's what I propose. One option is to use taxes. It could be a special tax on blank discs or internet connectivity, or it could just be general revenues. The crucial thing is how to spend the money. The money which is allocated for this purpose should go directly to authors and artists and only to these people who participated creatively, not to companies. And it should be based, how much anyone gets should be based on her popularity, not on some bureaucrat's decision. But it should not be distributed in linear proportion to popularity, because if superstar A has 1,000 times the popularity of fairly successful artist B, and if we distribute the money in linear proportion, the superstar will get 1,000 times as much. Well, that means either we have to pay lots and lots of money and make superstar A terribly rich, or we're not supporting artist B enough. So what I propose to do is, don't make it in linear proportion, make it in proportion to the cube root of the artist's popularity. So if A is 1,000 times as popular as B, A will get 10 times as much as B, not 1,000 times as much. So what this will end up doing, if it's a fixed pot of money to be distributed, B will get more than he would have got, and A will get less than he would have got. But A will still get more than B. But the point is that with a function like this, we can use the same amount of money to adequately support a larger number of fairly successful artists. And each superstar will still get more than a non-superstar, but they won't get most of the money.
How would it fund enterprises? I mean, it takes a lot of people
There, I'm not sure how it would work. The director would get it. Or the director and the actors and the writer and the composer. The gaffer would have to be paid by them, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I agree, the gaffers would have to get paid. But they won't work if they're not. But in any case, the other idea is voluntary payments. Suppose, now voluntary payments actually are starting to work pretty well for supporting artists. I saw an article recently with a lot of examples of musicians who have switched over essentially to letting their fans pay them voluntarily and creatively offering many options to pay varying different amounts of money, and for some of them you would get a gift. And if you pay $10,000, you might get to spend a week with them. You know, the point is they have all sorts of things you can do. And it's working. But it's working despite the fact that it's a pain in the neck. What I have in mind is to make it easier to send a small amount of money. I mean, sure, there are some people who would like to pay $100 or $10,000, and they don't mind if it's a certain amount of work they have to do. But there are a lot more people who would be happy to pay $1. But the amount of work you'd have to go through is so much, you wouldn't bother. And then not only that, but if you paid $1, they would get a half a dollar or less because these payment systems are not efficient. So what I have in mind is set up an efficient anonymous payment system where every player has a button, and you push the button and it sends a dollar to the artist that made the work you're listening to or watching or just did. And then you can push it if you like, or you don't have to. But why wouldn't you? If it's just a dollar, why wouldn't you? Is there anyone here who couldn't afford to send a dollar once every week to some artists? Why anonymity?
What about my anonymity?
Well, it should be set up to be anonymous. And the technology exists. It's a matter of deciding to put it into place. You know, the technology exists to collect tolls from your car as you drive by anonymously, too. The reason they don't want to do that is not because it's hard.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it was all that was worked out in the 1980s by David Chaum, and he set up a company to try to build those systems, but that's not what they chose to do because preserving people's privacy was not one of the goals. So, is there anyone here who couldn't afford to send a dollar once a week? Wow. Of course, there are some people who can't afford that, and they won't. And that's fine. We don't have to squeeze money out of poor people to support the arts, because there are plenty of non-poor people who will be happy to send it. And when you look at how effectively voluntary payments are already working, it's clear that they can do the job, but the easier we make it, the more of the job they'll do. So the third idea is a way of combining parts of those two. It's called the global patronage system, and it was invented by Francis Muguet, who, sad to say, died last September. And I also contributed to it. Here's how it works. Every internet subscriber has to pay a monthly fee, which goes to the ISP, to be divided among artists. But the subscriber gets to choose how to divide a part of it. Maybe that'll be 30%. So if you paid, say, you paid your fee, well, you could divide up to 30% and among whatever works you choose, as you choose. And so that part would go to the people who made those works. The rest, plus the money of whoever didn't bother to specify how to divide up any of his contribution, would all be divided among the same people. But the explicit allocations would provide a measure of popularity for each artist, and then you take the cube root of that and use that to divide up the rest of the money. And the cleverest part of this was to have the money pass from the ISP to the collecting societies, which are then required to give them to the artists. And by using the existing legal relationships, it eliminates some legal obstacles to implementing the system. In any case, that is what I have to say. So now I'd like to answer questions. Please speak slowly. I am hard of hearing.
Okay. Well, the way how you tell the story is very interesting, but I see a paradigm here that for me is also very interesting. If, for example, I'm an artist or a scientist or a writer, you know, and I give everything free, you know, I would not give back. I wouldn't have money, you know, for my work.
That's not true. That misrepresents the existing facts.
No, but see, follow me. That means I will do it for free, you see, because I like the concept. Because it means that if everybody is doing the same, you know, everything is also free for me. Which means that, the concept of money disappears.
But I'm not being so radical. And what you're saying, you know, you're changing the subject. You're discussing an idea that is more radical even than Marx, as far as I know, and is very different from what I'm talking about. But in the process, you're misrepresenting the effects of the existing copyright system. Remember that scientists generally don't make any money from copyright. So the idea that if they didn't use copyright to restrict their works, that they would somehow not get money, that's wrong. And then look at most musicians. They don't get any money from copyright.
I as a scientist, you know, I don't do things initially for money, you see?
That's right, you don't.
Scientists should do also art, not for money.
Well, the thing is, most artists are not doing their art mainly for money. That's right. Most of them never get enough money to be corrupted by it. They start out wanting people to see and appreciate their work. And most artists never bring in enough money to start to wish for anything else. But there are a few who get successful, and there are really, really few who get very successful. And they can be morally corrupted by all the money they get, but there are so few of them. So most artists just continue doing art for the same initial reason that they want their art to be seen. But the thing is, we would like a system to support artists. And our system does support a fraction of artists. It's just that it does it in a very inefficient way. And at the expense of our freedom. And so I want to reclaim the freedom that we must have. But I'd also like to support artists better, preferably more efficiently, so that we could use less money to support the artists better.
Yeah, but the last thing is that, see, that I think money is the one that is making you not free, and that goes like, well, I...
You're being far more radical than I am. I'm not talking about eliminating money. After all, there are a lot of jobs that need to be done in life which are not artistic, and which I wouldn't do unless I were getting paid. You know, I wouldn't want to be a garbage collector. You'd have to pay me to do that. I wouldn't want to be a farmer. You'd have to pay me to do that.
How do you reconcile the concept of which you're not really necessarily privy to the code to with applications that are free software.
Well, the term web application is a confusion term because it blurs over the crucial distinction between software that you have on your machine and software running on somebody else's server. So to think about the ethics of these, you need to keep those two cases distinguished. So so the software that you'd run on your own machine, like many Google services, for instance, will install a non-free program onto your machine silently. They won't tell you, but if you use NoScript, you can stop them. Obviously, the software that runs on your machine has to be free. But what about the software on the server? Well, servers do lots of different things. And I think that the crucial question has to do with what the server is doing. There's one particular case where servers take away from you the control of your computing. And that is software as a service, where you do your computing on somebody else's server. And that takes away your control of your computing the same way proprietary software does. With proprietary software, you typically get an executable and no source code. And that means that to study and change what it does is theoretically possible, but so hard you would generally not even think of trying. With software as a service, you don't have the executable and you won't either. You don't have the source code or the executable, which means it's not just prohibitively hard to study and change what it's doing, it's impossible to study and change what it's doing. So just as for your freedom's sake you must reject proprietary software, you must also reject software as a service. There is simply no remedy to make either of those safe for your freedom, so the remedy is don't use them. I don't think that's a meaningful term. The terms free and proprietary, as I've defined them, have very specific meanings. And you're trying to use the same words in a different area, but with a totally different meaning. And the confusion here is you're picking the same words to imply that there's some sort of parallel, but the meaning is not the same. So it's just misleading to use the same words. You choose different words. That's actually a different issue. I'm afraid you've confused two different issues. But please, you've mixed up two problems. No. There's a big problem of hardware whose specifications are secret and that we can't control with free software. But that's not limited to Apple. That you find all over. No, it's much worse than that. You know, the video accelerators in most PCs, their hardware is secret too, although people are reverse engineering it and making progress. But basically, you're confusing two totally different problems. One of them is devices like those video accelerators whose specs are secret, so we can't see how to write free software to use them. The other issue is things like the IBAD. That is a different problem. You know, the shocking problem with the IBAD is not a matter of talking to the hardware. No, it's that Apple controls what applications you can install. But that has nothing to do with the hardware. That's because Apple just gave you a system and they decided to seize this new power. Well, not mine. The point is, the first step is don't be defeatist. Don't say, these devices are entering our lives. No, it's up to us whether to let them into our lives. By treating it as a foregone conclusion that people are going to accept this, you're being defeatist. Well, that depends on whether you want to pay for some.
Right.
There are lots of people you can buy support for free software from.
Absolutely, but you know, my thoughts are people are willing to pay a lot more money for licenses because of the illusion of support. Where do you see the support?
Well, I mean, you can try to start a company to sell licensed copies for which people are entitled to get support. The software can be free, but only the people who bought the copies with their support contracts will get support. I don't think they have been terribly successful. Well, there is some. At this point, I think the only non-free software in Fedora is inside Linux, the kernel. They have not been willing to remove the non-free software from their version of Linux. So the rest of Fedora is a GNU plus Linux system. Linux is one program in there. And that's the only program in Fedora at present which is not free software. In the back, you were waiting a while.
So, in regards to the free software, what do we do about quality control and malicious programs?
Well, malicious programs are usually found in proprietary software. There's only one defense against malicious features being put into software, and that is if the users control the software, as they do with free software. The four freedoms are the freedoms necessary so that the users are in control. With non-free software, the users don't control it, so they're basically helpless. And if a developer decides to put in something malicious, there is no defense. What about them? I don't understand you. That's too vague. Well, what's that got to do with this issue?
Well, if it's free and people are allowed to use it, how do you know the good from bad?
Because, well, actually, you've got it backwards. When the program is not free, how do you know the good from the bad? You can't tell. There's no way to tell. And if you do find something bad, there's nothing you can do about it. So we know of malicious features in many widely used non-free programs, and yet they continue to be malicious. If those were free programs, people would have fixed them by now.
Each year it seems that traditional compact disc sales are declining and online digital distribution of media is increasing. One of the promises of this is that it ideally puts more money into the hands of artists and frees them from some of these...
I don't believe that. Since you seem to be talking about music, if these sales are going through the record companies, that's not going to give artists any more money.
But if I'm an artist, then I can deal directly with iTunes or
Well, you shouldn't deal with iTunes, but you could sell directly, and yes, it's working. I mean, there are lots of musicians that are selling directly to the public and making money and even cooperating with sharing at the same time. Not at all. Sharing is good, and sharing must be legal. And the fact that more and more musicians are making money by essentially giving their fans opportunities to buy things in a way that is entirely compatible with legalized sharing shows that the results of legalized sharing will be good.
About flash and other types of
Well, flash is bad.
I mean,
because, let me say why. Okay, you asked me about it, now I'm going to say. I'm going to answer. Okay, flash is bad because there is no free software that supports the latest versions of flash. Now, the reason for this is just that Adobe is a moving target that we haven't been able to close up on. We keep working on extending GNASH, but we can't catch up with them.
Yeah, it just seems to be a pretty recursive problem every time I try to use free software.
Basically, the thing to do is tell sites stop using flash. It's bad for them to use flash.
But at the same time, it seems like it's impossible to get video content online without it.
I don't know. Well, what do you mean impossible? What do you mean impossible? You mean that the sites demand you use it?
If you want to watch the video content, then...
Well, I won't. I mean, I care about my... Now, I believe GNASH does work with YouTube. So, there are certainly some video you can watch. But I won't do that. Because I want to fight for freedom, and I'm not going to... undermine this fight for some unimportant pleasure. I could do something else that's a pleasure.
But so there's something in the works.
Yeah, we're working on it. The problem is that by the time we implement Flash 10, Adobe may have implemented Flash 12. Who knows?
GNASH works. It's just, as you said, it's usually a little bit behind times.
The answer is in HTML5.
Well, yeah, HTML5... But the thing is it an answer? HTML5 makes it easy to embed a video into your web page without using Flash. If you want to do that, you can do it. The problem is that many of the companies refuse to use the only unpatented video codec, which is the Ogg Theora video codec. But that's the only one that... whose use is not bad for users' freedom.
This is also, I'm a Flash developer, and this is also up to the people who develop Flash. Every version of Adobe's Flash Professional that comes out, you can publish and choose to publish back versions of Flash.
And none of them do.
An action script in Flash 8, in Action Script 3, hasn't changed. So you can do all of the very complex things that you want to do with Flash as a programming language and still publish it for use by even the free software.
Well, I wish people would do that. Maybe you have a way of spreading the word, urging people to do that. But another issue I believe is that Flash makes the website inaccessible. Another reason not to use Flash in websites.
You mentioned earlier, just a few minutes ago, that a lot of the major corporations that embed codecs don't like the Ogg format. Why is that? Why do they just reject it?
I don't know. I don't know. These are companies like Microsoft and Apple. It's hard to tell why they do what they do. I don't know if it's about DRM, but in any case, any patented or secret format is unacceptable.
Being as someone who has written much more software for a lot longer than I have, do you have any tips or pointers that you could give?
About what?
About writing software, readability, and also...
Oh. Let one thing at a time, please.
Sorry.
Please don't ask me to remember two questions while I answer one. One thing is, anytime there's a bug, go immediately to the debugger and start systematically localizing the error by putting in breakpoints and stepping. Usually, you will save time this way. I see that people waste a lot of time trying to avoid going to the trouble of using the debugger. They try varying the inputs and trying to see if they can intuit from the pattern of failure or non-failure where the bug must be. It doesn't work. You think it's going to be a shortcut. It's not. It's actually the recipe to that. That's the path by which you could take any amount of time and never get there. Whereas once you start using the debugger, you will get there. It takes a certain amount of time, and then you'll get there. So wisdom consists of starting down that path immediately.
Also, I just wanted to see if there was anything about programming languages in general.
Learn Lisp. If you don't know Lisp, you have no idea how powerful a programming language can be and how elegant.
Thank you.
People tell me that Python is a lot like Lisp. They're wrong. It's not true. I read about Python, so I now can tell you that no. Well, in a few ways it is, but in the really important ways it's not. In Lisp, you start Lisp and you're in a read, eval, print loop. Python doesn't have read, it doesn't have eval, and it doesn't have print. So that shows you that more than a little bit is missing. Well, I'm not interested in open source. I've never been in favor of open source. Open source is just a way for people to talk about free software and avoid raising the important ethical issues. So if you care, as I do, about freedom, one way you can help the cause is don't use the term open source. Talk about free software and freedom. And another way to help make it clear that it's free isn't freedom is to say libre or libre. Or pronounce it as in English, Libra software, free/Libra. The point is the need to clarify to people that we don't mean gratis, it's not that hard. And it's crucial to bring up the issue of freedom, and that's exactly what open source doesn't do. If you start looking at the projects that describe themselves as open source, you'll find that any idea of freedom as a goal is completely absent from most of them. They, and many of them are happy to recommend and use non-free programs as long as it helps them get their specific practical work done, which means that they're setting a bad example and spreading a debilitating message to the community. You'll never get to freedom that way.
What about games?
What about games?
Like, you say, you know, all information technology should be free.
Software, I said.
Software, sorry. But would you say that a game such as, you know, for lack of a better word, like Modern Warfare 2 is not...
I don't know what that is, but I do know what I have seen... free games that are very impressive.
Yeah.
And however, some games are just software. But some games are software together with story text and music and art. And if you as a developer choose to keep those parts to make a clear separation between those parts, then you could treat each part as what it is. And so the code would be software, it's in the first category. The story text, the music, and the art, that's in the third category. And each one could be treated legally as what it is.
Oh,
well, you shouldn't call it that. Well, it's digital restrictions management, but continue. Well, I hope so, but you don't, who knows? The point is, it's never wise to assume you're going to win. It's never wise to underestimate the enemy. We don't know if they're going to give up. So let's get ready to fight. Let's assume they're not going to give up. And making the world a worse place. So the goal is to put an end to that. Yes, lots of people are getting paid to do harm. Well, first of all, I think what you said is not exactly true. A lot of work gets done by volunteers on free software. But there are also a lot of paid developers of free software, and I don't know how they're all getting paid. I just know they're there. Well, they may work doing anything. Yeah, a lot of people work on free software as volunteers, and they have jobs doing something else, and it could be anything else. Well, wait, sorry. Have you just made a strange assumption somewhere? If somebody volunteers to work on free software and has a job, that job could be anything in the world. What? So you're trying to say, I mean, look, programmers are such a tiny fraction of society that if you're trying to bring up the issue, the macroeconomic issue of unemployment figures, this is hardly a drop in the bucket there. It makes no sense to argue anything about software based on the total number of jobs or the total number of people who are employed or not. Most of the unemployed people don't know how to write software. I mean, I'm afraid that you're assuming ties between issues that are not only different, but their sizes are totally different. If we want to discuss how to deal with the problem of unemployment, the solution to that has nothing to do with proprietary software. Proprietary software is a scheme for concentrating wealth, and it's going to result overall in fewer people having jobs. But mainly, it's simply the wrong issue. Free versus proprietary software is just the wrong thing to bring up if we're trying to solve the problem of unemployment and poverty in general. Though most of those people don't know how to program. Whatever we do with software development, it's not going to affect that issue. And meanwhile, there's no reason to assume that free software volunteers that have jobs doing something else, that those jobs are programming. Those jobs could be anything. Many of them are. And most programmers who are paid are not developing proprietary software, because that's a small fraction of paid programming work. Most of them are developing custom software. And there is no conflict between the proprietary software means you say, here's this program, buy a copy. Custom software means a client says, I'd like a program written to do this. And you say, I could write it for this much money.
Okay, do you have to distribute the source code with that?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Your question is too vague. Well, that depends, right? If he's not stupid, he'll insist on that. But a lot of them may be really stupid.
Okay, I didn't mean to hijack the previous.
Okay, the point is that
custom
means that you're writing code to the specifications supplied by whoever's paying.
So are you pro-custom?
I have nothing against developing custom software. And the point is that even in a world where all software is free, the clients that want custom software developed are going to have to pay just as they have to pay now. I don't understand that over non-custom software. Sorry, you're confusing different issues. Custom software means it was written for somebody's specifications.
Okay. Somebody has web space. They want you to write a web application. You write that application. It's custom software.
Yeah.
Would you use it?
I don't know. I mean, first of all, does it run on my machine or does it run on someone else's machine? See, the term web application doesn't make that clear. So the point is, that's why I object to the term web application, because it ignores this crucial distinction between software that runs on the client and software that runs on a server. I use web servers that aren't mine, and I don't use them to do software as a service, however. Software as a service I refuse to use. I don't know what you mean by that. I'm trying to say precise things, and you're changing my words into other words that I don't know what the meaning of is. Well, I don't know. The point is, I use web servers which are not software as a service. For instance, I'll use search engines. They're not software as a service. They're not doing my computing. They're looking in somebody else's data. So, in fact, most websites are not software as a service. I usually refuse to do e-commerce, but that's for a different reason. It's because it's not anonymous, and I want to maintain my anonymity. But if I could do anonymous e-commerce, I would, because that's not software as a service. That transaction is not my personal own computing. It's a joint activity between two parties. I don't know what you've said. You've asked me a question which leaves out all the important details by which I would decide. Oh, to a search engine. Well, then I would be okay, because I don't mind using the search engine. Right now, when I use a search engine, I don't use some API. I just use a browser. But I don't think that makes an important difference, whether it's an API used by some special program or just I use it with a browser. So the point is, you're focusing on one particular detail, which happens to be a detail I don't think is crucial to my decision. So when you tell me a scenario that only gives that one detail, all I can say is, I don't know, because you haven't told me the aspects of the situation that would affect my decision. Google Docs. Okay, now, there are two things wrong with Google Docs. First of all, in order to use it, you have to install a large, non-free JavaScript program in your own browser. So that's proprietary client software. But, okay, let's suppose that they made that free software and eliminated that issue. The other problem is it's software as a service. You're doing your editing in their machine. I'm not going to do my editing in their machine. I'm going to do it in my machine. And I want to store my data in my machine. Of course, control of your data is an issue that can arise in many situations, not just software as a service. And you have to think about that, but I don't have a simple rule about when it's safe to trust somebody with some of your data.
Okay, could you give the base elements that would be a service that you wouldn't control?
If you're doing your computing with it, then it's software as a service and you shouldn't do that. But there, most servers, though, what you do in them is not your computing. So, for instance, if I edit a Wikipedia page, I'm not doing my computing. I'm doing Wikipedia's computing. Totally different issue in terms of who ought to control it. No, it's okay. Because the point is, since it's not my computing, I have I'm not being denied control over my computing. The objection doesn't apply. Wikipedia has control over its computing, as it should. And if I participate in Wikipedia's computing, there's no reason why I should expect to have control over that. Wikipedia should have control over that.
You're saying as a collective without a mastermind,
It's a collective, and as a collective, it has control over its computing. So different kinds of servers raise different issues. And that's why I don't want to say anything about, quote, web applications, unquote. They're different from each other ethically, and they raise different kinds of issues. And I don't want to make a blanket statement about all of them. Your software must be free to be ethical. Ethically speaking, your software should be free, whether or not it uses some feature of some other free software. Now, but I have a feeling from your question that you're mixing up an ethical issue with a legal issue. You see, the GNU-GPL in certain cases would require your software legally to be free. But that's a legal question, which is a totally different area from questions about right and wrong. I don't know, but I'm sure that would depend on lots of details. The point is, though, non-free software is an attack on the freedom of the users, and it's always wrong. In some cases, it may be illegal, but it's always wrong. Well, I don't understand what the difference is, because that distinction is something that people invented in the past decade or two, and I can never remember it. In any case, if you want to teach people to be good at software development, you've got to give them the chance to do real projects that last real periods of time and get their work installed into programs that people are really using and get bug reports and fix the bugs. Now, that means that it's got to last, say, 2 years. So I would say there should be a 2-year project in which in the first year you write the code and convince the developers of a free program to install it, which means that you had to pay attention to what they want. At the beginning, you've got to talk with them and see what features they would like to add, and see what kind of conventions they follow so that you can write your code and make sure they're going to be happy with it so that they'll install it. And then you've got to participate in fixing the problems that the users report. Now, the problem with most academic projects is somebody writes a program and he hands it over and says, grade it. It's done. Well, you learn something from that, but you only learn about some of the parts of the job of actually contributing changes to a programming project. So what I'm proposing would involve all the aspects of contributing code to a program, not just the part where you write something. Yeah, I think it's time to stop. I've been answering questions for half an hour now. I'll answer one more.
How do you recognize free software? And what I'm getting at is, does that mean to you that you have to have the GPL license?
Well, no. Please, these are two different questions. The GNU GPL is one of many free software licenses. Any license that gives the users the four freedoms is a free software license. For more info, look at GNU.org. There's as much info as you would like. But in terms of how do you tell, well, if you want to study a program and check for yourself if it's free, well, you've got to see what all the licenses are that are used on the parts of it, and then see if those licenses qualify. But we have a long list of many licenses saying that they do or they don't qualify, so you don't have to think about that ab initio. And if you come across a license that we don't say anything about, mail it to us, and we'll think about it. But practically speaking, you don't usually have to do this, because if you install an entirely free GNU/Linux distro, then all the packets that are in it are free. And so when you're installing the packages that are in it, you know they're free. You don't have to check. The free GNU/Linux distros can be found in gnu.org/distros. But they include, for instance, GNUSense.
What would you suggest to a non-technical person?
I don't know. Well, does it matter? They may all be equally good in terms of that. I mean, what makes a distro better or worse for a non-technical person? It's better if it has a graphical user interface. I suppose they all have graphical user interfaces now. I mean, they'll either have GNOME or they'll have KDE.